From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past April when a series of new polls showed something really massive happening with the youth vote in this country. 4 years ago, Joe Biden won the youth vote category by around 20 points. Young voters are categorized as being typically under 30. Sometimes you'll see it as 18 to 24. We're thinking of it as 18 to 29. Democrats have dominated this category for years, although young Americans vote in smaller numbers than older Americans. The youth vote peaked in 1970 at about 56%, and that was supposed to be the start of stronger civic engagement among young Americans. But youth voting ebbed and flowed over the years and seemed to bottom out in 2016. And so this past spring, Democrats were stunned by a series of polling showing that the youth vote split much more closely between the Democrat, Joe Biden at the time, and the Republican, Donald Trump. Analysts questioned whether the polls were realistic, but it wasn't just one poll. Trump had closed the youth vote gap to single digits in the poll from, for example, the Harvard Institute of Politics. Other polls showed nearly a virtual tie. And unless those polls were wildly wrong, Joe Biden was in trouble. Well, Joe Biden is not the candidate. Last week, the Harvard Institute of Politics released a new poll and found that Vice President Kamala Harris leads former President Trump by around 31 points in the youth vote category. Once again, Democrats appear poised to dominate this category. The question is whether young voters will turn out. But the Trump campaign would like to believe the story is different. A recent poll from the New York Times found Harris leading the youth vote by around 20 points, but Trump leads with men age 18 to 29 outright, while Harris's lead with women 18 to 29 is huge, about 38 points. Trump's chances are fueled by his lead with men of all ages. He's counting on young men to not only vote for him, but to turn out in much larger numbers than they have in the past. In particular, Trump is dominating with men who have less overall education, and his campaign wants to get more men in that category registered to vote. So what are the issues that animate younger voters? It turns out young voters diverge pretty strongly from their parents and their grandparents on a number of major areas, and we're going to talk about that with our guest this hour. In studio with us, back with us is Austin DeLorme, who's a student senator at the University of Rochester and a community advocate. Welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
And on the line with us is Jordan Schwartz, who is a sophomore at Harvard College studying government. Jordan, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me back, Evan.
Let me start with Austin in studio. And you're 18 years old. This is your first time voting.
Yes, it is.
How do you feel?
Amazing, but at the same time, what a strange political environment we are in. It is a strange time to be 18 and starting to actually get involved in the process, hands-on.
Well, I know you've been thinking about this for a number of years. Is it kind of surreal that this is actually happening now?
Yes and no. Again, yes, because it's crazy, but no, because I've been involved, and a lot of young people have been involved for a long time now, and I think it's just our time to emerge and show an older demographic what we're all about and what we believe.
And you are going to be voting in this election. Generally, you feel like you're going to vote a straight ticket. What do you expect?
I'm always open-minded to all candidates. I like to know policy, not just party. But I definitely feel like I'm leaning one way more than the other right now.
And what way is that?
That is Republican.
Okay. And you're going to vote Republican at the top of the ticket for former President Trump?
As of now, yes.
Okay. And we're going to talk to Austin more in a moment about the issues, as he says, issues and policy over party. But what is it that has him leaning Republican? We're going to talk about that coming up. Jordan, for you, what has this election season been like for you? And tell us where your leanings go.
Yeah, so this election season has definitely been the culmination of four very chaotic years in American politics, especially for young people. And I think we've also seen that it's also a really interesting time, because we're seeing this increased engagement among the group of 18 to 29-year-olds, despite the fact that they're still pretty disillusioned with the state of American politics. And even if they're more likely to vote than they were in the spring, more enthusiastic about Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, depending on their preferences, they are still very down on our institutions in America.
Yeah.
But for me personally, I'm super excited for this election. And I honestly do believe that Kamala Harris has a great vision for the country, and that perhaps if we can get a government of Democrats elected across the board, then maybe we can create policies that can address some of that disillusionment. But I'm really excited to hear the perspectives that Austin and others have as well.
Well, so let me say at the outset here, this was just a situation where the people who are available to come in and talk today, this hour, were young men. So we don't have young women on the panel. But in a sense, I really do want to explore this gender gap and from this male perspective. Donald Trump is leading outright by anywhere from 8 to 13 points in recent polls I've seen with men age 18 to 29. And men age 18 to 29 are historically not really strong candidates to actually register and go vote. And so the Trump campaign wants to change that. They want them registered. They want them showing up to vote. But his lead is real in multiple polls in that category. Whereas Kamala Harris's lead with women is massive. And 38 points in a recent New York Times and Siena poll, various other polls around 30 to 40 points with women age 18 to 29. So let me start with this. I mean, Austin, you know, you're in that category, 18 to 29. Trump is leading with men. He is getting kind of crushed among young women. What is this gender gap about? Do you have any explanations for it?
I mean, I would attribute it to a few things, but I think the main thing is culture. I think that right now there's a big appeal for cultural demographics, especially among men and women. I think the Trump campaign is doing great with that, putting out ads about being there for blue-collar workers, people are of necessarily not college-educated, but wanting to get into the workforce, addressing economic issues. I think that Kamala, on the other hand, is doing a great job appealing to women, especially, I mean, if you look at her campaign accounts on TikTok, Instagram, anywhere, Twitter or X now, she puts out these ads that are really inspiring and hopeful, and I think that they too are also pop culture-y in a sense of not necessarily addressing issues, but trying to reach out, extend a hand, and like I said, just give hope necessarily to what young women see as, you know, in their view, rights being taken away.
Austin, in a lot of the polling that I've seen, and the New York Times did a piece about this recently, one of the consistent refrains that men age 18 to 29, and by the way, Austin and Jordan are speaking for themselves. They're not speaking for all people aged 18 to 29. They can't do that, but they can offer their perspective, of course. And one of the things that the Times reported on was an idea that young adult men have that they're concerned about whether they're going to have an economic opportunity to provide for their family in the future, that change is happening rapidly, and they want what they view as a more traditional opportunity to go into the workforce, to provide for a family, to be a breadwinner. And they view Trump in very sort of typical traditional masculine terms in that way. Do you feel that way?
I could see definitely how some people would see that. Me, not necessarily. I don't see it exactly like that, but I definitely do see that motto and that mantra of, you know, masculinity, like you said, trying to be the breadwinner, trying to provide for a family, trying to have traditional values. And I think that's what Trump is really about in the campaign. He said multiple times that he's for traditional family values. So in my mind, that would make sense as a logical explanation to the polling data.
Okay. Let me ask Jordan about that. This gender gap, first of all, Jordan, it's a huge gap, and it is not just one poll. It looks very real across the board, by the way, in all age categories, but especially 18 to 29, a 50-point gender gap, 51-point gender gap. Amazing. What do you attribute that to?
I mean, I think there are honestly a whole host of factors, but I think you did hit it pretty much right on the head earlier, where a lot of people are stressed out about economic issues, and even if they don't necessarily like Trump's character or support the Republican Party on a lot of social issues, they do have economic concerns, and they view Trump, in my view, mistakenly, but still nonetheless do view Trump as someone who is economically better for them, and from that like perspective of someone who wants to be a breadwinner, who wants to provide for their future family if they're going to have one. And so we've also seen this huge divergence, and I totally agree with Austin here, that the two campaigns are clearly marketing a lot of their advertisement differently for each gender, where Democrats have done a really terrible job of reaching out to young men. And obviously, as a Democrat, that's something I want to see change. But reaching out to those working class communities, appealing to those economic concerns, and making sure that young men don't just feel left behind would be so critical. Because at least in our polling, we've seen that while this gender gap does exist in terms of party identification and who candidates are going to actually vote for, it really does not exist to the same degree in terms of the underlying policy preferences and honestly the basic like underlying ideological factors, whether that's support for like large government intervention in healthcare or providing opportunities to help the climate or a number of factors like that. Sure, there is a gap, but it's nowhere near the 50-point gap that we see in terms of voting intention. So I think really trying to rectify that is a priority for the Democratic Party, to show people, hey, we do care about you. We're not leaving young men behind. And then if that happens, Democrats can maybe win back some of the young men that they've lost.
I'm going to spend a lot of time on individual issues, policy ideas, issues animating our guests. Let me just ask separately about a strategy that the Trump campaign has decided that they want to sit down with a lot of the most popular podcasters that are huge with young men. Here's part of the list that Donald Trump has spent time with recently: Lex Fridman, Theo Von, Aiden Ross, Logan Paul. Those are some of the most popular podcasts literally in the world. And if listeners, if you're going, well, I've never heard of them, well, that may just mean that they're not sort of on your radar, or it might be a sort of a demographic thing, but they are huge. They are. I had not known, so I'll put my hand up and say Theo Von was new to me. Theo Von, very popular. Austin Smiling. Are these names, are they popular with you? Do you know these guys?
I know the names. Theo Von, I was going to say, is actually one of the names that I recognize most from that list. That was kind of funny to me.
Logan Paul, Lex Fridman. I don't think he's done Rogan. Of course, Rogan is perhaps the most popular podcast going right now. But this is a strategy that the campaign has. I mean, are you a podcast listener, Austin?
Occasionally. Not as much, but occasionally.
You're not like a... You know, every day you're going to class and walking across campus and you got Aiden Ross or Logan Paul or Theo Von in your head?
Definitely not.
No. Okay. Okay. What do you make of the strategy that Trump has to try to reach people through these podcasts?
I think it's a very good strategy, actually. I think, especially because of the Trump campaign's view, and Trump specifically, his view on media, it's a great way to appeal directly to a demographic of people that necessarily he wouldn't be able to get to with mainstream media. Or there might be, I don't want to say censorship because that makes it sound devious, but a blocking of certain things being said directly to a large group of people.
Okay. And so, Jordan, for you, Lex Fridman, Theo Von, Aiden Ross, Logan Paul, how familiar are those names to you?
Can't say I'm a regular or at all listener, but I have heard the names come up a lot in our conversations.
Would you advise the Harris campaign to have Harris or Walls or both with some of those podcasters?
I mean, honestly, I'd be surprised if all of those podcasters were willing to have a representative from the Harris campaign on their shows. But at the same time, I would not be opposed to, like, actually.
I think they would. No?
Well, I mean, honestly, I'd love to see it try and happen. I would love to see more of that outreach across the aisle and to those groups. So I remain hopeful. But I do think, like, the Harris campaign can do more to reach the influencers, not just on TikTok, but on those spaces. One of our big poll findings was looking at, like, social media use across, like, men and women. And there's a huge gender gap in terms of which platforms are used most. So for young women, it's TikTok, whereas for young men, it's YouTube. And I think that's where we're seeing a lot of the divide, too. We've got these, like, manosphere podcast bro influencers on YouTube and other platforms like that that don't necessarily reach the female audience in the same way that the TikTokers do, and then vice versa, which is definitely contributing to some of the polarizing effects we're seeing today.
So Jordan, let's talk a little bit more then about how you think, your preferences for Kamala Harris. You want to see whoever is at the top of any ticket focused on issues that matter to you, and you think that the Democratic Party writ large has not done a good job in recent years at reaching out to working class voters, at not just reaching out, but making sure that either the policy matches their needs or that they understand what those policies are designed to do. So what does that actually look like in practice? Has that started to change with Harris at the top of the ticket? Take me more through that.
Yeah, I think the message certainly has changed. So even from Biden to Harris, we've seen a transition in terms of what policies are being talked about for helping the working class. And Harris's new agenda is really to try and build a middle class through not like the neoliberal policies of ages past, but directly trying to help people with their most basic cost of living concerns, whether that's trying to bring down the house or price of housing through a whole variety of methods, or trying to address inflation more broadly. And I think it's more direct because people aren't experiencing economic concerns as like numbers in a spreadsheet or a graph of GDP. And so I think that's where the Biden admin has largely been unsuccessful, where you just aren't able to convince people that life is good by showing them numbers. But what the Harris campaign is trying to do is trying to really look at what is causing these sources of financial stress. Is it your rent? Is it your housing prices? Is it the price of groceries if you're looking down the aisle? And it's really getting to those like basic foundational things that people see day in and day out and trying to address that, that the economic messaging is being pointed at now. That said, I think right now it's also being targeted towards a group that is already very Democratic leaning and would be primarily voting for Harris either way. So the question is, how can we take this message of supporting working class Americans, of making everyday life affordable again, and get it into these circles of young men, of working class people who aren't necessarily the strongest Democratic supporters, who may be politically disengaged, and who certainly aren't hyped up on Democratic TikTok following Kamala HQ 24/7. Because if you can get beyond that bubble, that's how you actually win people over.
I mean, you'd like them all hyped up following Kamala HQ 24/7, I think, Jordan.
Oh, I mean, for sure.
Okay, but realistically, I hear you. All right, let me follow one point Jordan's making, and then I want to ask Austin the same question about what it means to really reach a young working class. But one of the issues you bring up, Jordan, is housing. This summer, I met a bartender in the Finger Lakes, and he had recently moved up to the Finger Lakes from New York City. And he said, you know, in his mid-20s, New York City housing wasn't happening. And so the hope was, you know, find not only work that he enjoys, but also better housing opportunities. And he said, even for, you know, mid-20s and kind of rural Finger Lakes, it's harder than you think to afford housing. He said that he thinks the biggest disconnect that maybe my generation, I'm 45, has with his in his mid-20s, early 20s, is that it is so much harder to find and afford housing if you are starting out in the workforce, if you don't have big family money backing you, if you don't have, you know, big advantages in life. It's a lot harder than a lot of adults listening right now may realize. And Jordan, do you agree with that? And if so, are you satisfied with what you're seeing, at least from the Harris campaign?
I mean, I 100% agree that it is a huge issue right now. I mean, just by the numbers alone, housing price inflation has been higher than just about any other basket. But I grew up in a pretty small town in Ohio that, at least when we moved there when I was one, had like the lowest housing prices in the country. And even there, people are struggling to find affordable housing, low rents, and houses that they can buy. But then if you translate that to a large city, a New York or a DC or Chicago or Boston, or even like any suburb in America, then I think by and large, you're going to see that people are really struggling with this issue. And it doesn't always show up on paper because most people aren't, you know, automatically trying to sell their house at any one point in time. But it is a very real stress where people are going, you know, paycheck to paycheck, or at least really struggling with their finances to make sure that they can have a roof over their heads. And there's this fear that's really widespread as a result. So in the spring of 2023, even, we asked a question asking people, how concerned are you with the possibility that you might one day be homeless? And these 18 to 29 year olds, a good third of people said that they were between somewhat and very concerned that they themselves could someday be homeless. And I think that underlies a lot of the financial stress we're seeing today, that people really don't have much hope for the future, or at least are not sure about it at all in the same way that previous generations were.
I thought it was interesting, Jordan, listening to Pete Buttigieg on the Bulwark podcast recently. He very strongly echoed what Barack Obama and other Democrats, including from Kamala Harris on down in her campaign, have said, which is essentially that Democrats feel like their well-intended efforts for the last 30 to 40 years to make sure that new housing development, whether it's apartments, single family, et cetera, the well-intended idea that you've got to be really careful about environmental rules and, you know, different ways of making sure that the housing doesn't do damage to a community, this well-intended effort to make sure that those certain lines aren't crossed, they made it very difficult to build anything at all. And Buttigieg was saying that's a lesson that the party's learned, and that you are seeing shift in the party to a lot more green lighting of projects, developments, building, et cetera. That's reflected in Harris saying that she wants 3 million new houses in her first term, although I don't know how she's going to get there exactly, but that's a goal. So are you comfortable with that? Do you feel like the party is seeing this issue in the way that you are seeing it?
Yes, I think the party is finally seeing the light on this. So like, obviously I'm liberal, right? Generally, regulation is not a bad thing. However, in the housing market, this is the one place where I think we need to greatly deregulate it. I'm 100% YIMBY-pilled on this and really think that like the two biggest issues facing housing in America are just general single-family zoning regulations that make it impossible for people to build housing that's actually affordable in suburbs and even within some of our largest cities. And then also just general underfunding of the housing and urban development agencies, because all of these public housing agencies are really underfunded, leading to all of this public housing that we have not having the money it needs to actually meet like the demands of the any given day. And so when you combine those two factors, both the private and public elements of the housing market are just really failing. And that's why I think we're seeing a lot of the problems right now. But then even if you compare like a state like New York to an area like Austin, Texas, where you have seen a rollback of regulations, and this is a rare example where I'll actually praise Texas deregulating something, but it works. We've seen massive increases in housing.
Yep.
And we know that once it is built, after it's deregulated, people's lives are better. Rents go down, housing prices go down, and people don't have the same financial stress that they do right now.
Well, let me ask Austin DeLorme about that. Austin DeLorme is a student senator at the University of Rochester and a community advocate. Let me start with housing, and then we'll kind of get wider on the economy. But on the subject of housing, for your cohort, you're just starting at the University of Rochester. Yep. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're not necessarily quite ready to think about buying or renting your own place, but you could be on living on campus. You could be renting nearby. You could choose to live at home. How do you view this issue of housing now, and how do you think it's affecting this 18 to 29 set?
I think it's affecting people to a huge degree negatively currently with the state of the economy. And I think one thing that's important to point out right now is when we talk about the candidate's economic policies specific to housing. I think that the Trump campaign, because we were talking before about appealing to a large demographic of workers, and especially people in this age range of 18 to 29, I think that Trump is doing a great job of highlighting the hypocrisy to an extent of what some of these Democrat solutions are. I mean, when you're looking at the Democrat solutions, Kamala Harris with her housing, ambitious housing project of building 3 million houses, it's almost impossible, like we said, with current regulations. And I think I agree with Jordan that we do need to deregulate in that sector. But also when we talk about giving stipends to families, first-time homebuyers, Kamala Harris wants to give a $25,000 incentive to homebuyers when they're buying homes. I don't think that's the right way to tackle this issue. I think that we need to have new solutions. And I think especially people my age that, like you said, going off to college, trying to find housing. I mean, housing on campuses is already expensive enough. You try to find an alternative off campus, especially in a place like Rochester in the city, it's almost just as expensive, and you're sharing with five or six other people. I mean, that's not an attainable way of life for young people, college students, and even people starting families in their early to mid-20s.
All right, so let's zoom out then. What are the kinds of solutions, ideas, policies that you think really are targeted to your generation that is struggling, especially with housing?
Yeah, well, like I said, I agree with Jordan that I think deregulation is a huge part of the conversation, especially when we see these zoning laws that are going on in places like New York, where it's very, very hard to create new developments that are not apartments, but are actual housing units. And then we have to look at a bigger picture. Who's buying this housing? I mean, if we look at examples in the past, 2008, a large part of it was because of the mass buying of houses and the control of the housing market. We have to analyze, and I'm not sure 100% what specific policies we would do to that, because I would need to look more into it. I'm not going to speak on something that I'm not overtly educated on. But I think that that's a conversation that needs to be had of what specifically can we do to tackle that issue in that specific area. What can we do to make it easy on families? Because at the end of the day, it should not be this hard in 2024 with the way that our political climate is to just start a family and buy a home. I mean, that's a basic principle of the American dream, is just to be able to buy a home and live your life and prosper. And it's so hard now. It's so unattainable.
Let me just follow with Austin, and then I'll send it over to Jordan as well. With one other thing that kind of came to my mind in the last week when I think about workers of all ages, young workers, I had to spend a lot of time in the last week just kind of on the phone with credit card companies, with trying to track down companies that might be scamming people. This very separately, Best Buy, don't sue me for this. I'm not talking about scams. This is just, I had to go into a Best Buy separately. I hadn't been in a Best Buy in a long time. It felt like there was nobody working there. I mean, like it was hard to find a human being in the store for a little while. And every time I had to make a phone call, everything is automated. Rarely do you get human beings on the line. And I feel like one thing that, I mean, maybe I would be feeling, and I'm projecting a little here, I'm guessing, but if I were 18 or 20 or 25, I might be really worried about the fact that not just AI, but I mean, the economic trends are to hire as few human beings as possible, to automate as much as possible. And the resulting user experience is pretty terrible. The customer experience is a lot worse. But there's fewer jobs. There's fewer people doing this work. Now, the unemployment rate, I understand, is very good overall. I don't know about the labor participation rate. I think that's a separate story. But Austin, I'd be worried more or concerned more with, are we building an economy that is still going to seek to employ people, to raise up people and families, not just to prioritize, how do we make everything as cheap as possible? How do we make everything as efficient as possible? And that means eliminating 3/4 of the workforce. Do you think about these things?
I do. And especially with local races, I look at what candidates are saying about why how they're going to stimulate the economy. And one of the things is, you know, stopping this mass exodus of manufacturing and jobs in the U.S. And I think a large part of this automation is that so many companies are sending their skilled workforces overseas, and even unskilled workforces in certain manufacturing industries, that a lot of these automations are because of this rapid shift in what demographics you need in certain areas. And I think part of the Republican and Trump economic policies and why they're so good at appealing on the economy is saying, you know, we're fighting for your right to work. We're fighting for you not to be taken over by AI or these automated robots or other machines that take away your right to work and take away these economic opportunities for you.
So one other question for Austin on this is, when you look at the manufacturing records, we're in this unusual situation where you have a candidate running for president, Donald Trump, who has been president, but he's not an incumbent. So we can look at his record 2017 through 2020. And what we see is there were more manufacturing jobs created in the last 3.5 years than there were in the previous 4. And what Trump and his team are saying is that they've learned a lot and that we're on the brink of a manufacturing boom if you only elect him. Do you feel like that's a real, do you believe that? I mean, like, is there a reason that you think, hey, I think the Republican on this ticket makes more sense than the Democrat for manufacturing, for more of the jobs I was just talking about, because X? Is there something that stands out?
Well, the thing that I always look at when it comes to talking about this issue specifically is we have to really look at the data. And there's a lot that goes into when a politician talks about numbers in the economy. Things are fudged all the time. And for me, I really want to look at when the administration says that, the Biden administration says this about this boom in manufacturing. Okay, well, is this bounce back jobs? Are these jobs that were added back into the economy because of the loss of labor during COVID? And in which case it would be an equalization, and there's not really this huge growth of manufacturing in the country, or is this an actual expansion? In my mind, I would think that this is a bounce back based on what we lost during COVID. But again, I would need to look at the numbers. And I think that politicians are very unhonest when they release this data.
All right. Jordan, you want to weigh in on some of this?
Yeah, sure. So I do think, like, building on Austin's point there, it's both. It's a bounce back and an expansion. So are the jobs numbers under Biden as fantastic as they look on an Instagram graphic? No, of course not. Every politician's going to spin. But there has been an expansion in manufacturing jobs. There has been an expansion in jobs on the whole, even above estimates that we had prior to the pandemic, right? That's a fact that economists have established. But once we go from that, the question is what's next? Because it's not just about the jobs we have today. It's about whether they're going to be available tomorrow. And that really comes down to building an economy that can work for everyday Americans, not just in 2024, but in 2034, 2044. And the way to do that is to figure out what industries are actually going to matter down the road. And step one for that was the Chips and Science Act, because we know that A, to be competitive on the national security perspective with China, we need to have our own domestic manufacturing capabilities for chips, because we cannot count on Taiwan when it is constantly under threat from China. But the second part of this is understanding that the future of American jobs and American manufacturing isn't just for automobiles or whatever traditional goods we've had in the past. It's for building the high-tech sector up, because we know AI is going to revolutionize everything. We know that the next technologies are not going to be the ones of 50 years ago, and that if we want to actually stay ahead and promote all sorts of American flourishing, not just for like the top 10%, but for every American worker, we're going to have to do that by investing in green energy to lead that transition, to make sure that the next vehicles we make are electric, and to make sure as well that new technology in the computing space, particularly with regards to AI, does happen here in America. So that's how we stay competitive on a global scale while at the same time supporting our manufacturing sector. And the most important part of all of that is guaranteeing that we do not leave the working class behind. Because it is so easy to just say, oh, we're going to let AI do all of it, or to, you know, allow people who graduate from Ivy League universities to have jobs in the consulting sector and leave everyone else behind because everything's automated. But that is not how we actually build America that works for us in the long term. That's not how we create prosperity and support for all sorts of our institutions down the road. And if we want an America for young people and old people alike that can actually be appreciated, where progress can be celebrated, then we have to get to that hard work of actually creating these jobs now and investing in a future that we want to live in.
All right, one more question on a subject we've already talked about. I wanted to follow up with Jordan. And then I want to shift a little bit and talk about what some of the recent polling in the Harvard Public Opinion Project among voters 18 to 29 says. But Jordan, I meant to ask you as well, you know, when you look at the gender gap and the way that 18 to 29-year-old men are supporting Donald Trump, they do talk a lot about traditional masculinity. Do you view Trump as traditionally masculine?
Personally, no. I think Trump's a con artist. I think he has this illusion around him that he's this strong man, that he can convince dictators to do whatever he says. And I think our lived reality is really different, right? This is not a family man. This is a man who slept with a porn star. This is not a man who led a successful business. This is a man who's gone bankrupt several times. And this is not a man who has convinced dictators to do his bidding. This is a man who has sent them love letters. And over we see these themes of Trump being, you know, the strong man, the solution to all of our problems, a strong leader. And I think that resonates with the people who don't follow the news super closely, who aren't hyper politically engaged. And we've even seen that within our own polling results. If you compare like the question of which candidate is more of a strong leader between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, then it's a lot more even among your overall population. But if you sort that to likely voters, the people who do pay attention to the news, it changes by like a 30-point margin to suddenly Kamala Harris is in a major lead with a position where she is viewed as the much stronger leader of the two candidates. But me personally, no, I don't think Donald Trump is a particularly strong leader, a traditional model of masculinity. To be honest, I think Tim Walz is a much better model of healthy masculinity, that you can be involved in football while still supporting your school's gay straight alliance, that you can be that person, that you can be, you know, a straight white guy from the Midwest and still support progress for other groups that have been historically marginalized. And I think that's the sort of masculinity that we actually have to promote in the Democratic Party and beyond.
Okay, so Austin, what do you think about Trump resonates in the way that a lot of young men do view him as a very masculine, like traditionally masculine person? If you heard Jordan's critique, what do you think is resonating with voters in your age group that says that's the masculine guy and that's the one that I want?
I mean, I would critique a lot of what Jordan said. I mean, one, he was a very successful businessman in New York City, which had a lot of give you successful or failing businesses. They were businesses, and he did create a lot of jobs for the economy in New York. When you look at him during his presidency, he was a very strong world leader. He avoided a lot of international conflicts and quelled a lot of violence and actually negotiated peace deals in the Middle East. And it takes a strong individual and a strong man to be able to do that. So this idea that he's not in touch with masculinity or he isn't what we look at as a traditional male role model, is he a traditional male role model necessarily? Maybe not. But he definitely is a strong man and a strong individual. It would be kind of mind-boggling to me to say that Tim Walz from Minnesota is more of this character that you would define as strong or someone to look up to.
Why is that? I mean, in some ways, you know, you could do really stereotypical stuff like, say, do you think Donald Trump could change a car tire? Well, no chance. I don't think so. Tim Walz, do you think he could change a car tire? Yes, for sure. Is that more masculine? I don't know. Women change car tires. But get beyond the stereotypical stuff. What do you look at with Tim Walz and think he is not as masculine as Trump?
Well, I want to be very careful with this because I think this question is subjective in a way
to talk about
masculinity. So I'm not going to go down the road of trying to name call or try to pick at both candidates and criticize in that way because I don't think that's constructive in any way. But I do definitely think if you're asking more directly on who is a male role model or this peak echelons of masculism, I think it's reflected through the polling. I think that young men identify and resonate because he appeals to their value sets and their ideas on a lot of cultural issues when it relates to men, such as, you know, the economy, with how they're going to how Donald Trump and his administration, like you kind of pointed at the top, is going to address these concerns with young men when it comes to how they're going to start families. In a way that I feel like Tim Walz in his tenure as Minnesota governor has not really focused on. I don't think that he's dived deep enough into resonating with this demographic of young male voters. So like I said, not going to name call. I don't think that that's constructive to the conversation.
Okay, fair enough. Jordan, anything you want to add before I pivot a little bit here?
Yeah, I would add that if you like actually look at the numbers for favorability for both, Trump is down 19 points, Walz is up 9. So young men, by and large, do actually prefer Tim Walz to Donald Trump, and I think that speaks volumes.
Let me shift a little bit here. One place where voters age 18 to 29 have pretty strongly different views or experiences compared to voters in their parents' or grandparents' generation is with immigration and within the experience with immigrants themselves. And this, from the Public Opinion Project, immigrants... voters 18 to 29 were asked if they agree with this statement. Immigrants improve the culture of the United States. 50% agree, 17% disagree. Immigrants increase crime in my community. 21% said yes, 45% said no. Immigrants are taking jobs that should go to Americans instead. 24% agree, 48% disagree. And only 12% of Americans in this polling, 18 to 29, say that they'd be uncomfortable if an immigrant moved next door to them. 60% have had classmates who have been immigrants. 46% have current friends who are immigrants. 41% have had immigrant coworkers. 40% have had immigrant neighbors. So in general, it is a generation that is much more comfortable with the not only the idea of immigration, but actually living with, working with, dating, being neighbors with immigrants themselves. Jordan, let me start with you. That polling, does anything stand out to you in that polling? What does that say to you?
That there's a huge difference we saw with the spring poll between how people see immigrants themselves and how they treat immigration. Because a majority of people agreed with the statement that the U.S. is experiencing an immigration crisis at the southern border. By and large, Democrats and Republicans alike agree that our immigration system as it exists today is deeply flawed. But at the same time, across party lines, this is a generation that sees immigrants as, you know, people with problems and lives to live that can be empathized with. And I think that sets us up for a pretty good foundation, regardless of people's views on policy, for a productive debate over immigration in this country if we can actually get to the point where we talk about policy. Because if most Americans can get behind this sentiment that immigrants are, you know, just people like us who are struggling for a better life, then we can talk about how do we actually make that happen without compromising people's worries within America for those economic concerns. And to be honest, the cultural concerns I think don't usually come up that much among young people. But by and large, it's a good foundation. I personally think that we have a long way to go still in terms of integrating pro-immigrant sentiment into sort of our daily political lives. But we do have that foundation right now where people are maybe more pro-immigrant than they are pro-immigration. And so if we can try and find a way to fix that system where we can still keep those human immigrants at the center of it, without compromising their rights and values while still fixing what we know to be a broken system, then I think we'll be on the right track.
Austin, what do you make of the polling on 18 to 29 year old Americans and their views on immigrants and immigration?
Well, I think that there's a very important distinction when we're looking at that polling, and it's the question that was asked. It's talking about immigration. It's not talking about illegal immigration. It's not talking about immigration in that sense. I think that we all, as individuals, can agree that immigration is really important to being able to build a national culture and a national economy. I mean, we are a nation of immigrants. We come from all over and contribute to building what we make as an American identity. So with that polling, that doesn't surprise me with what the question was asked. But I'd be interested to see if we talked and we put illegal immigration in there, how views would necessarily change on that. Because I think when it comes to the human aspects of saying that you've had a class with an immigrant or something of that such, I mean, immigrants are people, legal or illegal. They're just people who are trying to come to the U.S. for better opportunities. But I'd be interested to see more generally the cultural shift with a different question.
I think the reason that the way these questions are framed is fair is because I appreciate your distinction, Austin, the difference between immigrants who are not here with any documentation versus those who've gone through a legal process, and is there a different view there? But obviously, the center of the political zeitgeist has been Springfield, Ohio, for the last month or so.
Yeah.
And at a recent Trump rally, he said that we're going to send those people back. And the crowd was chanting, send them back, send them back. They are not only here by and large, they are not only here legally. They started coming here during the Trump administration on special orders that the Trump administration approved. And so I'm not sure it's fair to say, well, we're, you know, Americans are fine with immigrants. They just don't want illegal immigration, when we're talking about sending people back who did come through legal processes, right?
Well, I think that's a different question and that's a different scenario. I would agree with you in that scenario. And again, this is part of politics where I think we have to recognize as individuals, if you are 100% with Democrats and what they say, or you are 100% with a Republican and what they say, you're just not being realistic, and you're probably not being genuine when it comes to
you're just on a team sport, right?
Yeah, and that's not fair, and this is a situation I would agree with you, but I would push back against, I think the illegal and legal immigration question is an important distinction. I think a lot of people would have different views. I mean, in that certain context that you said about Springfield, 100% agree. There would probably be more consistent answers with that because of that scenario that you outlined, but I do think there's a difference.
All right, so let me get some, I've got a little bit of feedback I want to share with listeners. I'm going to take a couple of phone calls. I've got some emails here. I'm going to start with Felicia and Victor. Hello, Felicia, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling about, I just wanted to make a comment on third parties. So I'm listening to the dialogue, and, you know, I think that both Austin and Jordan, they really have a lot of valid concerns. I think young people are facing a future where there's like a ton of issues we have to address. The price of living is out of control. Student and consumer debt is at record highs. I mean, good jobs are hard to find. And like you were saying, increasingly being replaced by AI. And then like the problem that's facing everybody in an existential way is extreme weather caused by climate change. I mean, these conditions aren't going to change with the interests of corporations influencing our government the way that they do now. And that's on both sides of the fence, like Republicans and Democrats. I work with a lot of young people, and many of them see the need to build something new now. And there are third-party options. We have to put the work into building these things if we ever want to counter what exists now. Claudia De La Cruz of the Party for Socialism and Liberation is actually touring upstate universities this week to speak directly with students. And she's going to be at the South Wedge Mission at 4 p.m. tomorrow to speak in for a Q&A with guest student speakers. So I guess that's my comment, but my question is, what do our guests think of third parties and the option for building an alternative?
Felicia, thank you for the phone call. Let me start with Austin DeLorme on that. Third-party candidates, what do you think?
Third-party to me is tough in right now in our political climate. In an ideal world, I think that a third-party system would work and would be beneficial. But right now, I think that we have a lot of common sense policies being put out by Republicans and Republican candidates that provide answers to a lot of concerns of young people and large voter demographics in general. So I would say that I don't see the need for a third party. I can see in certain scenarios or situations where it could be influential or helpful, but not at this time.
Claudia De La Cruz is I was going to say she is the socialist candidate. She is the, well, her website is votesocialist2024.com. I'm going to say I don't think Austin DeLorme is voting socialist.
I would not probably vote socialist, probably, and I would not agree with that third party.
But I think Felicia's point is that she sees a lot of ills of capitalism. That's a big part of the Claudia De La Cruz campaign. And she doesn't see either major party in this country addressing those issues. Jordan, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, there are totally lots of issues that don't get addressed by either party. But at the same time, there's not a single third party ticket right now that is remotely serious. I mean, the PSL ticket is by and large unconstitutional because both of the people who are on the ballot for that ticket are from the state of New York, which is not allowed under the Constitution. Jill Stein submitted her name not for candidacy, but for a ballot initiative in Nevada. And Chase Oliver is polling at 1%, same with Cornel West. So these are not serious campaigns. They don't have a chance of victory. And they're going to be spoilers, if anything. But now that RFK Jr. has actually dropped out, there's no serious third-party contention in America in 2024. Of course, it'd be wonderful to have options for third parties that can actually make change or push the boundaries in a given election. But that's not how our system works right now, certainly not with the Electoral College. And even as it is with a winner-take-all electoral system, even if the Electoral College were abolished, it would not work in America. Third parties may have some success when there's ranked choice voting available. They may have some success even when open primaries exist. And they might have some success in local races. But on the national level in particular, third party votes are basically just a waste of a ballot. That's plain and simple.
I would tell listeners that we had Jill Stein on this program earlier this year. That conversation is archived. We can throw it in the show notes if you want to see it. And we talked to candidates who are on the ballot. That's part of our promise to listeners. You know, we're not trying to exclude anybody from the conversation. I do appreciate that, Felicia. Thank you for the phone call. Yeah, and boy, there's not a lot of noise from the Libertarians this year. Maybe we need to talk to Libertarians soon about what's it feels like they're in a little bit of a down period.
Yeah.
Let me get Sue and Pet Nian on the phone next. Hello, Sue. Go ahead.
Thank you. I do have some concerns. I was just looking up Mr. Trump's policies online, and one of the things that I noticed is that the fellows were talking about some of the housing difficulties, and I agree, they're a huge problem in this country. Mr. Trump's talking about reducing housing costs by preventing undocumented immigrants from getting mortgages, whereas the young men who are on your show are talking about much more specific ways of remediating that problem by addressing perhaps local housing restrictions. And one of the things that I think I've noticed across the board is that Mr. Trump doesn't talk about details at all about how any of these problems are going to be addressed. And it always seems as though it's people who are supporting his campaign that are coming up with the real nuts and bolts solutions. And I'm concerned because I don't think the man has any ideas of his own about how to really solve problems. And I find that concerning. I don't know whether any of the people on your panel would choose to.
Yeah, let me start with Jordan. Anything you want to add, Jordan? Thank you, Sue.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth mentioning that for most of his life, Donald Trump was a Democrat. He only became a Republican once he decided he wanted to run for office. So he does not have any consistent policy positions unless he thinks they're going to help him electorally or just help his image more broadly. And so whether that's on housing, whether it's on immigration, whether it's on climate, whether it's on foreign policy, he's not going to have a concrete position of any sort. And that's why we didn't see a Republican Party platform in 2020. And the one we have in 2024 is basically 20 minutes of Donald Trump rambling being written down on paper. And it's not going to be consistent. Believe me, I desperately want to go back to the days where the Republican Party stood for something, even if it was something that I disagreed with, because that's the foundation for having any sort of realistic debate, where we can actually talk about whose values are more important than whose values and whose policies are better than whose policies. But right now, that is not the reality we're living in. And until it is, we're going to have a very hard time creating any sort of bipartisan dialogue or real progress in America.
Okay, Austin?
I would push back against that strongly, especially seeing that Kamala Harris's solutions to the housing market have been so broad, whether it's 3 million new homes, it's pie in the sky idea, whether it's giving incentives or money to new home buyers, that's pie in the high incentive. And do I think there needs to be more specification on some of these issues? Yes, but let's not forget that it's Kamala Harris who only 4 or 5 years ago, when she was still a senator, did flip-flop on her issues on immigration, did flip-flop on her issues on the environment when she became a serious contender for the presidential race. So I think it's unfair to say that's a solely unique Donald Trump thing, but I do hear the sentiments, and I do think that there needs to be more consistent policy advice.
We have less than a minute, so about 25 seconds. Keep it tight, Austin. Donald Trump and Republicans will do better with young voters if what?
If they get more consistent, clear messaging, and if they reach out to them on social media and try to communicate this message of economics, not necessarily name-calling.
Okay. Jordan, same question. Not about Trump,
yeah,
though,
continue.
About Harris.
Yes. No, Harris needs to continue the unity messaging, but try and reach broader platforms, be willing to speak to the press on these things, and overall say that we can build a better America for every person, and we can do it without hurting anyone. And in order to actually make that happen, we have concrete policies. You're not going to agree with all of them, but it's important to say that we do have a plan and we're going to make it happen.
I want to thank our guests for making the time. Especially on short notice, what an interesting conversation. Please come back. Jordan Schwartz, a sophomore at Harvard College studying government. You're welcome anytime. Thank you for making time for the program today, Jordan.
Thanks.
And Austin DeLorme, student senator at the University of Rochester in his first year there. He's really enjoying it. I've even have some of your professors texting me during the show, and they really appreciate you already. So, hey, great
nice.
Work there. Thank you for coming on the program. Let's talk again soon. You're welcome anytime.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've got more connections.